G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 26 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. How great are seaplanes? In my mind, they are the best part of aviation. It's why I got into flying and it's why I started this podcast, to talk all about float planes and flying boats. To get in contact with me, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at thatmallardguy. Come and say hi, tell me about how you're loving the show, suggest a guest even. I reply to everyone who takes the effort to talk to me, so don't be shy at all. Now before we get into this episode's surprise, there are some seaplane events to discuss. While we can't all gather in Oshkosh this year due to its shutdown from COVID-19, we can still share the spirit of aviation. The EAA is running a Spirit of Aviation Week on July 21st through to the 25th, which will celebrate the entire aviation community by showcasing the spectrum of flight in a virtual way. One of those ways is a webinar, and one of the webinars involved includes the Magnix and Harbour Air flight of the all-electric Beaver floatplane late last year. This talk is the story of the audacious path to get there, going through the technical challenges, the regulatory collaboration, operational considerations, and culminating in the first flight and follow-on steps. Check it out at eaatogether.org on Tuesday the 21st of July at 12 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. And I'm guessing that's some American time, but not sure. Thanks to Ralph Strahm, a big fan of the pod from California, for bringing that to my attention. Another seaplane-related item on the Australian agenda at the moment is the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, or CASA, have put an advisory circular, or AC, about the design and operation of water aerodromes out. This AC will be of interest to persons involved in the design, construction and operation of water aerodromes, proponents of water aerodromes, planning authorities, aerodrome and aircraft landing area operators, and the Civil Aviation Safety Authority. This is the initial AC for the design and operation of Australian water aerodromes. CASA is seeking feedback on whether it provides adequate guidance on the requirements for water aerodromes and is fit for purpose. A copy of the draft AC is provided on their website. Just Google CASA AC water aerodromes and you'll find it. Please read the document before providing your feedback in the online survey. Now, just a reminder, CASA can no longer offer the option to upload files because of the potential risk of malware, so your response must be text only. Hope you're all good at explaining things with words. Good on you, CASA. It'd be great to get a big response from the Australian seaplane pilots in our industry, so please tell people about it and get your responses in. They must be in by the 28th of July. Okay, folks, it's time to get to the main part of the episode. As I mentioned today, I have a surprise. You've all been waiting very patiently, and now it's time to reveal it. My guest today is, drumroll, nobody. Don't worry, you don't have to sit through an hour of silence because I'm doing my own presentation. Last year, when we flew to the Rathmines Catalina Festival in Lake Macquarie, New South Wales, I did a PowerPoint presentation on the topic of gear-down water landings. And I've modified it slightly to present to you all via this podcast. It is a topic I have a passion for, as I believe this is an accident that shouldn't be happening at all. I would like to say that I do not wish to put blame on certain individuals, but use past accidents as ways we can all learn and hopefully prevent this happening in the future. I by no means think that I'm an expert on the subject, just wish to provide my opinion from my experiences and research to help others avoid this simple catastrophe. I also respect that this topic could cause some distress for some listeners. Folks, after this episode, I'll be taking a month off. I have a few things on, including family visiting, and will be spending the time catching up with them. Plus, I've been flat out getting 2 episodes a week to you all, so I'm actually ready to have a little break. But don't stress, I'll be back with more episodes from your favourite podcast on the 19th of August, continuing with 2 episodes a week. Also, I've been working behind the scenes on a couple of great episodes to share with you all while I'm away, including one I'll keep as a surprise, but it's a must-listen episode, and another episode which was a practice interview I did with a great mate of mine before I actually started the real thing. It's actually a great chat, and he has some great experiences in aviation, including getting a free floatplane endorsement, so keep an eye out for that one as well. But for now, folks, it's time to check our landing gear. preparing for our water landing, we'll confirm visually that the wheels are up and locked before completing the required checklist. After touchdown, we'll add some power, keeping the aircraft safely on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Okay, folks, the gear down water landing is a pretty serious topic. It is one that has actually personally affected me as well. It is one that all seaplane pilots should respect the serious nature of. If you haven't had sweaty nightmares regarding it, then there is something wrong with you. This episode is all about why does it happen, who is likely to do it, when is it most likely, and how can we prevent it from happening. How did it affect me personally? Well, my father's Cessna 206, the one I cut my teeth on flying floats, finished its career floating upside down with the wheels on display. After I moved to the Whitsundays, the aircraft was fitted with amphibious floats. I actually only flew it on straight PKs. Now my dad, Greg, watched his own aircraft, his pride and joy, his years of hard work, land wheels down at the Geelong waterfront in front of his own eyes. This was the last water landing the aircraft did, as it forced the closure of his company. Luckily, no one was seriously injured. Not only is this topic a personal one for me, it is something that we still see happen in the seaplane industry today. So I wanted to do this episode for you all to hopefully prevent one of us from allowing this simple mistake to occur. If I can help prevent one accident from happening, then I'll be happy. Not that I can measure it that, but anyway. I have a few questions for you all. Who thinks at some time in the future another wheels down water landing will occur? Now, who thinks it's going to be them? We all think that it will occur, but we don't think that it's going to be one of us who does it. Someone's got to do it. Why won't it be you? Who thinks that your current procedures and your current thought processes that are in place in your operation, be it privately or commercially, are the best they can be to protect you from being that person in the future? I think ours, flying the Mallard, are close to perfect, but even we could improve. I think like most accidents, thinking that we are perfect, thinking that everything is covered, leaves us complacent and exposed to making mistakes. Hopefully on this episode, everyone listening will take something away from this discussion to ensure that we as a group aren't the ones who do the next wheels down water landing that is going to happen in the future. Before we go any further, I want to bust a few myths. The first one, I'm a straight float pilot, so this episode doesn't affect me. Sure, it's pretty hard to do a wheels down water landing when you don't have wheels. But if you are a private owner of a straight float seaplane or are currently working for an operator who only flies straight floats and you're not already thinking about gear every landing, you are digging a big hole for yourself when the day comes that you do fly an amphibian machine. The procedures, flows, thought patterns will transfer over, especially in a stressful, high workload environment, and you'll leave yourself vulnerable to this type of accident. So please, if you are one of these pilots, take this presentation as seriously as those who currently fly amphibs. The next myth is, I'm an experienced pilot. It won't happen to me. There certainly are some very experienced seaplane pilots who listen to this podcast or who I've had on as a guest. However, as aviators, we should always thrive to learn and improve ourselves. And as my study results will show later, it certainly isn't just the junior pilots who leave the gear down. Now, we have all seen footage of a wheels down water landing. There's a famous one on YouTube you can see. The funny thing is, generally speaking, the pilots were flying completely serviceable aircraft. They were functioning completely normal. All of their indications were correct. If you think about it, the aircraft is even configured safely for a landing. Everything, generally, is normal, except for the landing surface. What results is a violent, dramatic, unexpected, life-threatening scenario. There aren't many other types of accidents like this in aviation, where normal turns to emergency in such a fast and unforgiving way. Landing an amphibious seaplane on the water with the gear down creates some obvious and maybe not so obvious costs. The obvious costs include the embarrassment, How did I forget such a simple thing? There's the aircraft damage. Most aircraft are probably written off. If you're a commercial pilot working for an operator, it could cost you your job. And there is also the financial burden the incident can cause to both operator and pilot. Some not so obvious costs may include post-traumatic stress. In my dad's case, for both operator and pilot, it caused depression, a career change, or once again, as we saw with my dad's company, the closure of a business, especially with those smaller operators. However, the most serious cost to an amphibian landing gear down in the water is the loss of life. It shows just how severe this simple, careless mistake can be. For this presentation, I searched the internet for seaplane accident reports involving gear down water landings. I focus mainly on single pilot aircraft such as Cessnas, Beavers and Lakes, etc. In total, I found 26 reports. The statistics I focused on were the most probable causes and factors, the flight hours of the pilot, the license type of the pilot, and the injuries sustained by both crew and passengers. The statistics I did not focus on were hours on aircraft type or hours on seaplanes, in particular amphibians. Now, some people might say that time on the water should be a consideration in statistics involving a gear down water landing. If you're one of those asking that question, I say to you, why? If I was to ask a pilot doing their initial amphibian float rating what configuration the undercarriage needs to be in for a water landing, they will tell me the answer before even getting into the aircraft to log their first minute. We are not talking about the physical stick and rudder skill of landing a seaplane. We are talking about a mindset issue, a procedural issue, a complacency issue, a general airmanship issue, which involves an aircraft being piloted to the water in the incorrect configuration for a water landing. The first set of statistics I gathered from the study of those accident reports is the license type of the flight crew on the aircraft. It was pretty evenly split between private, 32%, commercial, 36%, and ATP at 32% also. A couple of alarming statistics regarding license type is that 32% were ATP qualified. Air transport pilots, supposedly the most highly trained, highly professional of all pilots, not configuring the gear properly for landing. Another staggering statistic is that 68% of these pilots were professionals. It shows that it happens to anyone, not just private pilots. Now, yes, it may be fair to say that private pilots don't fly as much as commercial pilots, so therefore per flight hour, they may have more accidents. This may be true, but we are talking about paid professionals here. Pilots who earn a living by safely flying paying passengers on aircraft, and yet they are still making the simple mistake of incorrectly configuring the landing gear when landing on the water. The next statistic I looked at was the pilot's total time in hours at the time of the accident. First, we have those from 0 to 1,000 hours making up 29% of the accidents. However, pilots with all levels of experience were involved in this type of accident. Some staggering figures showed that a fifth of the pilots had over 10,000 hours. Over 50% had more than 4,000 hours, and 71% had more than 1,000 hours. No matter where you are in your career, you do not become invincible. You do not become immune from this accident occurring simply because you're experienced, simply because you're now flying the Mallard at Pass Bailey, simply because you're an experienced airline captain. Every amphibious water landing requires the same attention, the same respect, the same focus, and the same mentality. What am I landing on, and what is the gear doing? Okay, now over to the whys of the gear down water landing, as we look at the probable causes and factors. These causes and factors were those found within the actual investigation reports, not by me coming up with my own conclusions. As mentioned previously, the total accidents I looked at were 26. Out of the 26, the total accidents that departed from a runway prior was a staggering 21. That's 80%. No or poor checklist use was considered a cause or factor in 14 out of the 26. That's just over half the cases. Distraction was considered a causal factor in 5 of the 26. Fatigue, mechanical issue, and mental state were each causes or factors in 2 out of the 26. Ignoring, disabling, or flying with an unserviceable landing gear advisory system was considered a causal factor in 4 of the 26 cases. And finally, inadvertently lowering the landing gear was found to be a causal factor in 2 of the 26 cases. Now, I want to go through each of these causes and factors separately. Departure from a runway. 80% of gear down accidents occurred when amphibious aircraft departed a land-based aerodrome prior. This statistic was the most common causal factor found while studying this topic. That means that throughout the after takeoff phase, throughout the cruise phase, and throughout the pre-landing phase of flight, pilots most likely did not consider their gear. On several occasions in my reading, pilots even noted slower cruise speeds, however concluded that they were due to faulty airspeed indications or even turbulent flight conditions. On another occasion, the gear was intentionally left down due to a long runway length for a return landing in the case of an engine failure. However, the gear was forgotten about and was never retracted. Distraction, fatigue, or mental state were considered causes or factors in 34% of the accidents I looked at. Some examples and potential solutions of each of these include distraction. Examples: interruptions, passengers, ATC, weather. Solutions: having a sterile cockpit, using the intercom isolate, or just saying stand by. Fatigue. Examples: difficulty concentrating, memory problems, task fixation. Solutions: consistent sleep patterns, short naps, and no alcohol or coffee before bed. Mental state. Examples: death of a family member, drug or alcohol use, stress. Solutions: recognizing the issue and saying no to a flight. Always easier said than done, I know. The intercom isolate is a great tool to avoid the distraction from passengers for both commercial and private operators. One of the accident reports I read involved a private pilot who was dealing with fatigue and a poor mental state due to the loss of a close family member about 2 weeks prior. It resulted in him landing wheels down on the water, in which his 8-year-old son drowned in the accident. Next, I want to talk about the Oral Landing Gear Advisory System. If you aren't aware, this is the system that makes an alerting announcement within the cockpit using a male voice for gear down and a female voice for gear up. The system is generally airspeed activated, alerting the pilot of the gear position when the speed falls below a set value. Not all aircraft are fitted with these systems. In fact, of the 4 seaplane operators I've worked for so far, only Hio Aviation in Vietnam actually used them. Now, 4 of the 26 accidents I looked at involved either ignoring, disabling, or flying with an unserviceable landing gear advisory system. On one occasion, the warning system was inadvertently activating throughout the cruise due to turbulent flight conditions causing fluctuations in airspeed. Not only did the pilot not react to the call out of the gear in the down position, but got so sick of hearing it that the pilot intentionally disabled the system by pulling the circuit breaker, intending to reset it before landing. It was never reset, and the aircraft landed on the water with the wheels down, and 2 of the 5 people on board died. The next causal factor was the inadvertent lowering of the landing gear. In 2 of the accident reports, the pilot unintentionally selected the gear to the down position for the landing on the water. One of those was a pilot of a buccaneer who was conducting circuit training on a lake. During its final approach, the pilot selected the gear down when reaching for the flap lever. Due to sun glare, the pilot was unable to see inside the cockpit to verify the correct lever, and the pilot was unable to visually verify the gear position using the external mirror, also due to the sun glare. However, continued the approach until landing and flipping the aircraft. Pilots who regularly flew retractable undercarriage aircraft before coming to the amphibian world are obviously susceptible to inadvertently selecting the gear down for any landing. In fact, at one company I worked for, on a pilot's initial training flight and first water landing, the pilot selected gear down as a matter of routine. The instructor was right onto it and left it for a while, only to shock the student late in the approach by pointing it out. The student was clearly shocked and embarrassed and learned a great lesson. The next causal factor was that of a mechanical issue, which out of the 26 incidents only occurred twice. One of the incidents was a failed hydraulic pump where the pilot had actually selected gear up after takeoff, followed by a landing with the gear lever in the up position. However, the gear never retracted due to the failed pump and was still locked down. Other types of mechanical issues that occur somewhat often in amphibians is the two up, two down scenario. Some of you may have heard about the incident involving Hotel Tango Oscar, the Australian Cessna 206 used in the movie Fool's Gold. It landed in Port Macquarie Airport about 8 years back in the two up, two down configuration. Needless to say, this incident wasn't included in my scope of incident reports, as the pilot was smart enough to firstly identify the mechanical fault, and secondly, smart enough to not attempt a landing on the water. Okay, to summarise the main causes and factors. First, we heard that departing from a runway was one of the most common events linking nearly all of the accidents. We heard that just like everyone in aviation, being distracted, fatigued, or having a bad mental state can have a negative effect on our safety as aviators. We heard that seaplanes aren't immune to mechanical issues and those associated with gear occur regularly. We heard that pilots can make mistakes and grab the wrong levers in the cockpit, hence why the gear and flap levers are designed the way that they are today. And finally, we hear how ignoring, disabling, or not fixing an unserviceable landing gear advisory system can lead to this accident occurring. There is another causal factor that was almost as commonly noted as the departure from a runway. In fact, I believe that if this thing was done properly, then all 26 out of the 26 accidents would not have occurred. It is the use of checklists. Departure from a runway. Complete your after takeoff checklist and realize you've missed retracting the gear. You just saved a paying passenger's life. Distraction, fatigue, mental state. The checklist isn't affected by those. Focus on your pre-landing checklist and you just picked up, you left your gear down. You just saved your partner's life. Mechanical issues. Complete a after takeoff checklist to remind yourself of visually looking at the gear. You just noticed the gear is down, but the handle is up. You just avoided writing off your pride and joy. Inadvertent lowering of the gear. Do a final checklist and you just realize you lowered the gear instead of the flaps. You just saved your own life. Landing gear advisory system. It was invented to create another defense against getting it all wrong. Do a checklist and you're twice as safe. You just saved a heap of lives. In all of the companies I've worked for, flying floats, I used checklists. They range from mental checklists such as bumfish, gump or puff, to flip cards on the yoke, to printed cards in the cockpit, to checklists through the Garmin touchscreen. No matter how the checklist was physically presented, I always made sure I used and followed it. Some tips for checklists include: keep it simple. Make sure it isn't so complicated that is turning you off using it. Keep it accessible. Flip cards attached to the yoke are great. You can see where you're up to and it doesn't take your attention too much away from flying the aircraft. Printed cards should be kept close, but be mindful they can get lost inside the aircraft. In the Mallard, we use the touchscreen Garmin GPS for our checklists, which is great for multi-crew, but maybe wouldn't be so good for single crew operations. If you hate checklists, then make sure the checklist mainly or only covers the killer items, such as a simple gear and flap check. Use the checklist as it is intended, to check that you have done something rather than as a to-do list. Conduct your flows, then use the checklist to confirm you've done everything that is needed. One thing in particular with checklists and gear that I'm passionate about is the actual process of the gear check. It is very easy to fall into the habit of just reciting words when doing checklists or just looking at one part, such as the selector. The gear check for me is a four-step process. Operating as a multi-crew now is slightly different, but when I was operating single pilot, this was my gear check. I am landing on the water. Gear is selected up for the water, indicating up for the water, and is visually up for the water. Or for the land, I am landing on the runway. Gear is selected down for the runway, indicating down for the runway, visually down for the runway. When talking about a landing surface, I like to actually point at where I was landing. This helped me switch on to the fact that I needed to concentrate. It also stopped me from saying the wrong thing and going down the wrong path. It is very hard to point at a white car and say that it's black. I then looked and pointed at what the gear selector was doing and made sure it matched what I wanted. Then I pointed and looked at the indicators, followed by a visual check of the gear with both the mirror and by looking at the nose of the float. I believe you really need to follow the whole process to make the gear check work. Okay, moving away from causes and factors now. The next statistic I looked at was the injury type received by all people involved in the accident, including both crew and passengers. So nearly 3/4 of people had no or minor injuries. However, 1 in 5 people on board received fatal injuries. That says to me that this accident isn't physically brutal, but instead most of those who died were probably due to drowning after the event. One alarming statistic relating to the fatal injuries were that 70% of all fatal injuries were passengers. In the majority of the accidents where the pilot died, they were the only person on board, so that statistic could have been much higher. For me, it really hits home that I could be responsible for a paying passenger, a friend, a loved one's death, people who put their trust in me to look after their safety, all by simply leaving the gear down. As pilots, we put a lot of time into training for emergencies. I wanted to take the opportunity to quickly talk about something amphibian pilots can do to train for an underwater escape, whether it's from a gear down landing or not. It's the Helicopter Underwater Escape Training, or HUET, course. Let me know via email or message if you've done it and what you thought. I did a HUET course back in the Whitsundays, and it certainly was an eye-opener. They teach you a mnemonic to remember the steps behind getting out, and then you do in-water training. It's only a day course, and it's worthwhile if you have the opportunity to go and do it. It may also give you a little insight into how traumatic a gear-down water landing would be. In Australia, CareFlight runs HUET courses quite regularly, and anyone can book a course at any stage. It's pretty funny, my wife Jenna, if you don't know already, is actually a commercial helicopter pilot, and in Australia it's almost expected that if you're a helicopter pilot, you won't get a job without this training certificate. They don't even land on the water. What about float planes? Well, just recently last year, Transport Canada Civil Aviation has introduced a new law stating that underwater exit training is to become mandatory for all pilots of commercial seaplanes, so they recognise the value in it. Maybe other agencies will follow soon after around the world. I wanted to finish this presentation today talking about undercarriage mentality. In my mind, there are 3 types of undercarriage pilots. The first is the pilot of the non-retractable or fixed undercarriage aircraft. This pilot doesn't need to think about gear at any stage of the flight. They may choose to, however, no change in flight characteristics or landing outcome due to gear will occur. Just like the wing, the gear is fixed, so there is nothing they can do. Next, we have the retractable undercarriage pilot. These pilots follow a rule to retract the gear after takeoff and then follow a rule to lower the gear for landing. Failure to follow these basic rules will cause slow cruise speed or other in-flight issues such as a gear speed exceedance, as well as the obvious serious damage to the aircraft on landing. Their mindset is trained into thinking that gear up is unsafe and gear down with associated green lights is safe. And then finally, we have the amphibian pilot. This pilot, unlike the fixed undercarriage pilot, first must actually think about gear. Then, once remembering the gear, must be smart and use their big brains to associate a landing surface with a gear position, unlike the retractable gear pilot who always puts their gear down for every landing. To an amphibian pilot, gear up can be safe and gear down with those pretty green lights can spell disaster. A good friend of mine used to go around telling people how proud he was about all the gear up landings he logged. Normal retractable pilots were shocked. The guy had thousands. Now, if you were to get 2 fresh pilots, one fixed gear pilot and one retractable gear pilot, to fly an amphibian, who would be the safer pilot considering gear. The fixed gear pilot needs to be introduced into considering gear throughout certain phases of their flight, and may fall back into the trap of forgetting gear altogether. But then the retractable pilot needs to be introduced into the concept that gear down and seeing green lights may not be the desired configuration. They may fall back into the routine of putting the gear down for landing. It goes to show that amphibian pilots are a completely different species of undercarriage pilot. We use our amphibian superpowers to avoid disaster. What am I landing on and what should my gear be doing? My belief is that if everyone can adopt this idea that you are not a fixed gear pilot, that you are not a retractable undercarriage pilot, but you are an amphibian pilot with an amphibian undercarriage mentality, we will dramatically decrease the risk of this unnecessary accident occurring. No matter what aircraft you are flying, whether it's back in a 172 or in a large twin turboprop commuter, get into the habit of thinking like an amphibian pilot. And that's the show for today, folks. I hope hearing my voice for so long didn't cause so much pain to your ears and brain. Please get in contact if you liked this presentation or even if you didn't. Like I said at the start, this is simply my opinion and hopefully it creates the discussions that prevent one of you from making this simple mistake. May even prevent me from doing it. Now is also the time to leave a review of the podcast as well. Like I said at the start of the show, I'll be taking a month off, but have two very cool bonus episodes coming out whilst I'm away having a break. So keep your eyes and ears out for those. Stay well, everyone. Blue skies and calm waters for you all. And until next time, thanks for coming on The Step.